Today we sat down with Richard Hein, a novelist, content creator, and political commentator. Previously, he was a publisher of Time Magazine's Latin American edition and vice president of marketing and business development at the Wall Street Journal. He created a Twitter parody account of President Trump called Real Donald Trump, which has been named one of the best Trump parody accounts by many major publications. He also created The Daily Edge and maintains a personal Twitter account, both very politically driven. He shared his thoughts on President Trump, the current political climate, cancel culture, and how social media has changed journalism. He also shared the origin of his Trump Twitter parody account and when the real President Trump conversed with him via the parody account on Twitter and eventually blocked him.
You live in New York City, but where were you raised and what or who inspired you to become a writer?
Well, I was born in London, and I always thought I would be a writer and bored people with that notion throughout my childhood. Didn't really get my act together and do it seriously until I was in New York after I'd been working in the corporate world for many years. And my novel that I first, my first novel came out in 2010, which was a satire set in the world of the media business and the newspaper publishing business specifically. And before that, in the 90s and early 2000s, I had published quite a few short stories in small literary publications, but it was my novel that, you know, I was really always thinking about, when am I going to get to write this novel? And I was working for many years at publications like Adweek, Time Magazine, and then the Wall Street Journal. And then finally I quit my job in the Wall Street Journal and finished a novel that eventually came out in 2010.
Now, with your wide range of experience as a novelist, media creator, you know, marketing, and it sounds like you may consider yourself a satirist with the parody account, et cetera, what do you consider yourself these days? It seems like with your personal Twitter, you've been getting a little more political. So how do you view yourself today?
Well, I think I'm one of the people that is on Twitter for political reasons every waking moment these days, and there's quite a few people who are very focused on the upcoming election and using whatever platforms they have for perhaps changing the party in power and things like that.
Now, you started the Donald Trump parody Twitter account, Donald J. Trump, you know, which is very popular. What inspired you to create? What inspired you to create this account, and what do you think about the reaction to it?
Well, it's the account is Real Donald Trump. It's the original Trump on Twitter since 2013. And what inspired me, the original, well, there's a backstory to it, but the inciting incident was really the Donald Trump's feud with Jon Stewart back in 2013 when he started to tweet and tell Jon Stewart that he shouldn't be ashamed of his heritage and said he should be using his real name, Jonathan Liebowitz, which many people thought was kind of an anti-Semitic dig at Jon Stewart, who I guess Trump felt was not being nice enough to him back then. So I knew at that moment that Trump himself had buried his heritage and often talked about being Swedish and not German, and the family name of Trump had been lost to the ages. So I resurrected that on a Twitter account right around the time of the feud with Jon Stewart. So my first tweet on May 6th, 2013 was, "Let's stop this fuckface von Clownstick nonsense. My real name is Drumpf. Let the rebranding of all my buildings begin." So that's how I kicked it off, and it didn't really take off immediately, but John Oliver made me slightly famous when he launched the Make Donald Drumpf Again campaign in 2016, and everyone thought that this account, Real Donald Trump, was somehow connected to the John Oliver show. So a lot of people started following me then, and then I was locked into it, I guess.
Now, obviously, some of the tweets from that your account, the Trump account, are satirical. What do you think? What has been one of the most realistic tweets from that account that sort of has come to life?
Well, I think what I've done is taken the intelligence of my followers for granted a little bit, so that they know, although oftentimes I'm told that they thought that they were reading a real Donald Trump tweet, So even today, people say, they start reading a tweet and it sounds like it's really Trump. Because oftentimes, to make fun of him, I do take an actual real tweet and just rewrite it. So today, on his way to Texas, I paraphrased what he was writing about going to Texas and fooled a few people, you know, until they got halfway through the tweet. But I fooled himself. One of the things that I think originally put the account on the map back in 2013 was when Trump started arguing with himself on Twitter. And one of the things that he was trying to do in those days, which he still does, is take a very small thing to blow himself up. So he tweeted an article from Fox News saying he had given a young black child a bike and said, you know, flashback. He was tweeting an old Fox News article, Donald Trump answers boys' prayers for new bike. So he tweeted an article about giving a child a bike to puff himself up, and it was not even a current story. So I replied to him and said, flashback, real Donald Trump runs full page ad calling for execution of five minority teens later found innocent, and attached the ad that he ran in the Daily News calling for the execution of the Central Park Five. So then he came back and started arguing with his own parody account, which was not the kind of thing that most people did in those days, and said, oh, really? Weren't they brutally mugging all people all over the park, and now they're seeking damages? Ridiculous. And I replied, the five kids were framed by police, robbed of their youth, and later exonerated 100% of the crime. Why do you oppose damages? At which point he blocked me, and I've been blocked ever since, despite all the lawsuits that other people have gotten themselves unblocked by Trump, because it's against the First Amendment for the president to be blocking people. But I guess he hasn't gone back and unblocked all the people he blocked through the years.
Have you had any engagement with besides Trump? And that is, it's very compelling that he was, you know, engaging in a discussion with a parody account. Have you had any? Has his family engaged with you, Eric, or any others on Twitter?
Well, I try and bash all of the Trumps regularly and often, and I have one of the reasons that the Trump account was started is I have another account called The Daily Edge, which I began in 2010. When I first joined Twitter, and for many years that was my main political focus on Twitter until 2016, when the Trump account took off, and now obviously, as you said, my personal account is much more political as well. So I actually use all three accounts. I've been blocked by most of the Trumps on one or all of my accounts, but Donald Trump Jr. hasn't seemed to block the Daily Edge, so I bash him frequently on the Daily Edge, and I often talk about his trip to Mongolia last summer, where he had his own hunter scandal, where he illegally shot a sheep, a rare and endangered sheep, under cover of night with a laser-sighted rifle. He killed a sheep, and it was illegal what he did, but he got out of the jam by calling in some political favors and then handed taxpayers a $75,000 bill for the trouble. So that's one of the things that I like to bash the Trumps for. Eric is seems to be the thinnest skinned of all of them. I think he's blocked me pretty much everywhere. Ivanka, I don't even know if she looks at her Twitter, but she doesn't seem to block too many people.
Social media has been a powerful force. How has social media changed journalism, and how has it impacted society?
Well, I think social media obviously has impacted society in every way imaginable in terms of how we create, consume, absorb, share information, and it's had a very disastrous effect on the media as we traditionally knew them. In my novel, which is set back in 2006. It was really, in my mind, and other people were saying at the time, that was the year that newspapers died, but they didn't really know it yet. And I think the problem that traditional media had through the years, through the early 2000s and through the last decade, is their inability to kind of monetize the traffic from the internet and social media and all of that, all of the eyeballs and the time. They didn't really monetize that in a meaningful way, and Facebook and Google and other people somehow became the publishers without any of the responsibility of being publishers. The media companies' revenue models fell apart. Facebook and Google got rich and then became platforms where everyone could become a publisher. Misinformation, disinformation, bots, Russian internet accounts from Macedonia, you name it. So social media has made it very difficult for truth to be something that is a shared concept. And we even saw it yesterday when Donald Trump Jr. was suspended from Twitter. Trump had a tweet canceled, and they're all complaining about it. The video about hydroxychloroquine with a doctor who doesn't seem to be very qualified to talk about COVID-19 was on a viral video, and Donald Trump, the president, tweeted that video and then later in the White House said she seemed like a very credible source for information, when in reality she's talking about things like aliens and demon seed being planted in people and I don't know what else, but not a very credible source from someone who should be listening more to Dr. Fauci than to what he sees on the internet.
Yeah, it is amazing these days. I mean, there's the phrase fake news, which some people use. What are your thoughts
right.
on fake news? And I mean, there's so many potential sources of and signals of information. You know, how do you navigate the truth?
Right. Well, when I joined Twitter back in 2010, and I'd just written this novel about the newspaper business and the death of print, in those days, fake news was The Daily Show, The Onion, The Borowitz Report. And when I joined Twitter, there were accounts such as LOLGOP and Tea Party Cat, which was a cat who modeled himself on Stephen Colbert. So the old days, fake news was comedy. It was Weekend Update on SNL. And what it has become now is real news. Anything called fake news is actually real news that the president doesn't like. And the term has now gone global so that presidents and prime ministers and dictators now call anything they don't like fake news. And their supporters now, in this age of tribalism, will rally around the term fake news to dismiss anything that they don't want to hear, whether it's wear a face mask, whether it's COVID-19 can kill you. We have a Republican congressman today, Louis Gohmert, telling us that he didn't want to ever wear a face mask, and now he feels that he got COVID-19 because he was wearing a face mask, which seems a little ridiculous, but that's the world we live in. I remember when I started out in Time Inc. in the 1990s, I was told by an editor there that the American people always had 5 to 10% who were kind of kooks, who would believe conspiracy theories and would, you know, were not really in the market for Time magazine or the New York Times. Now what we see is, because of the internet, because of the different channels of information, because of the relentless propaganda from Fox News since 1996, because of Rush Limbaugh, because of what's happened with YouTube and Alex Jones and InfoWars, and now with Trump being his own channel of disinformation and misinformation, that there's really, it's not 5 to 10% of the population anymore. It's the base of the Trump political machine. It's the base of the Republican Party, and that turns out to be 30 to 40% of the population that's not really open to a discussion of science and facts and what is real and what is true, because if the leader says something's true, that must be true, or if someone can tie it to the Bible, then that must be true. And Darwinism is no longer taught in science class because creationism is of equal merit. So we're in a world where science and facts have been really destroyed in the minds of a large part of the population, and that makes it very difficult for real news and shared truth to be a part of the conversation.
Yeah, you bring up the idea of alternative facts these days.
Right.
I don't know if any of your family or friends, or I know New York is pretty traditionally liberal. I don't know but if you have any friends or family who are supporters of Trump or are leaning right, it's interesting to see folks, they could be watching the same video, reading the same news, and literally take away something different from it. I find that amazing. So I don't know if you've had that have you had that experience with anyone before?
Well, certainly, and I'm now, obviously I get a lot of replies and comments on my tweets, on these three accounts that I mentioned, but I get shocked that people can come back at me with the beliefs that they have based on news that we're told, whether it's about face masks, the virus, the truth about what's happening in any aspect of society. I mean, one of the things that I've tried to do this year, I've started a newsletter on Substack with my Daily Edge that is really trying to just pick apart some of the accepted facts about Trump that even the mainstream media has kind of gone along with, because, as you brought up, this whole notion of journalism being kind of a battered industry and not having the resources it used to have, there's a lot of lazy journalism in the mainstream media that accepts as a fact certain claims about the blissful 3 years that we had under Donald Trump until the coronavirus arrived, which is a complete fabrication. And Trump repeats it day in and day out that it was the greatest economy in the world and everything was wine and roses for his first 3 years. And it was just this China virus that did us all in, instead of the fact that, the recession began in February at a time when he said the economy was the greatest in the world. Manufacturing was in a recession for the whole of 2019, and many other facts, and all the promises that Trump made, except for judges, except for 3 miles of wall, have gone up in smoke, and people are not really discussing the reality of Trump's 4 years, because now we're also focused on the plague and the crash.
Yeah, how has COVID-19 impacted the political and social climate today? And what are your predictions? What do you think is going to happen in this next election?
Well, it's not a time for complacency. As people on Twitter have been pointing out, Dukakis was 15 points ahead in the polls in 1988, and the Willie Horton ad from Bush Sr. and a lot of other dirty tricks it did in Mike Dukakis, and he rode in a tank probably at the wrong moment. But this year, I think there is a huge, huge danger of the worst forms of dirty tricks, hacking of the election, abuse of power from Trump and Barr, anything, any lever that they can pull to stay in power, they will be pulling. So it's a very scary time, I think, in America right now. What we're seeing in Portland, what will spread to other cities, is very scary, with the federal police force reporting to Trump and Barr, with the tear gassing of protesters that we saw in Washington, D.C., or pepper spraying, or whatever chemical agent it was. They were brutalized and moved out of the way in order to have a photo op. And I think the danger right now is that Democrats are always too complacent. They think that voting will be smooth. They think that the true winner will emerge on when the votes are counted. And I don't think that's a guarantee in any way, shape, or form. from the new postmaster general that Trump has installed, who's already announcing that the mail will be slowed down and mail-in ballots may not all arrive in time, to the hiring of Karl Rove to help him. Karl Rove, the most notorious dirty trickster in stealing elections since Roger Stone, or since before Roger Stone's days, I should say. Karl Rove is now on the Trump team. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be scared about democracy being throttled and killed this year. What do they used to say? Drowning government in the bathtub. I think that's the plan for democracy this year if Trump and Putin and Mitch McConnell have their way. So it's a very difficult time, and what happens with the election because of the virus, it's going to be very difficult for people to vote. It's going to be very difficult for them to know that their mail-in ballots are going to be counted. It's going to be very difficult for them to trust the voting machines that have been installed. And there's lots of reports about even, 2016 not being as squeaky clean as everyone likes to pretend. I think I did an interview on my newsletter recently with Jennifer Cohn, who's an election security advocate, and she laid out all of the very, very serious challenges and concerns that are surrounding this election, and that's on top of what we know about the gerrymandering and the voter suppression and kicking people off the voter rolls with all of the tactics that the Republican Party has been using, and then the signature matching and the challenging that will happen if people don't exactly make their signatures match on their ballots to their signatures on file. There's all kinds of shenanigans that could happen. And I think it's a very, very worrying time. And it should be. The real test of democracy is if the person who wins by one vote is declared the winner, that is democracy. And I think it's a very, very serious tragedy for America that Democrats are being told, if you don't win by a huge margin, we won't win. And that's even in not just the popular vote in the Electoral College, but in all these races, down ballot, everywhere else. And obviously, we know it's true because of gerrymandering that Democrats have to, in general, win by several percentage points in the House to win a national majority. But I think it's a disastrous turn of events that a 15-point lead in the polls is no guarantee of victory on Election Day. We know that Hillary won by 3 million and lost, and if Biden wins by 5 million, there's many scenarios where he could still lose in the Electoral College. So even that aside, the monkey business that could go on in districts and with software and with mail-in ballots is setting the stage for disaster, and Democrats always seem so complacent and not taking this seriously enough.
Is there hope in democracy in your mind? I mean, the far left, would, some may say, want to burn down the system and rebuild it. I mean, is there hope for democracy?
Well, I think the hope for democracy in the short term is really a centrist candidate like Biden. If he can convince enough independents and enough disgruntled Republicans that there is a way back to normalcy and decency, it may not please the far left progressive wing of the party completely, but I think Uncle Joe is probably the best candidate for the moment in terms of both the notion of stability and restoring what is possible. Obviously, there's a lot of people who might say, well, restoring this two-party system is not the greatest idea in the world. But between now and November, we don't have any other choice than restoring, democratic rule and restoring stability, decency, competence, and hopefully getting the economy back on track, healthcare for people, saving the planet. I mean, not reelecting Trump will be a disaster for the planet, let alone America. There are bigger issues than, the two-party system and democracies. It's like if we don't get any kind of sense of normal behavior back, then the world is just kind of spiraling out of control in my mind. And we see it around the world. I mean, Brazil, Poland, Hungary, many other countries are now in this, nationalistic fervor. And Putin is, and Erdogan in Turkey and other countries are modeling the behaviors that these would-be dictators or actual dictators are now going to want to emulate. And in Turkey, even, it came out today that they're going to start this whole new round of censorship on social media. So obviously Trump will be looking at things like that and saying, oh, that's not a bad idea for my third term.
You mentioned censorship, and there's the phrase cancel culture.
Right.
I'm curious, do you believe cancel culture is real, and what are your thoughts on that, as well as censorship?
My thoughts are, I believe in free speech and the First Amendment, and I believe that people should be allowed to say what they want to say. The traditional view that sunlight is the best disinfectant is what is really getting us into trouble, though, because now what is happening is that the toxic viewpoints are being spouted by the president of the country and other world leaders, so that this notion that sunlight is the best disinfectant for potentially fascist thoughts is no longer true when one of the two ruling parties is going to march in lockstep with the person putting forward the, fascist authoritarian viewpoints. So my hope is that somehow there's an adjustment. If Biden wins, we can have normalcy and a normal conversation again. But things are so off the rails that it's hard to imagine how things can get back to anything like they were. I mean, this whole notion of make America great again, when Joe Biden was part of what Trump, they criticized Biden for his 40 or 50 years in public life, and those are the times that Trump wants to restore us to, when Biden has been part of the greatest period of progress and prosperity and innovation in American history. But to this notion of cancel culture, I think it's very difficult for me to make a sweeping pronouncement, because everyone should be allowed to be stupid. Everyone should be allowed to say stupid things. But to me, the most important thing is, what are you doing today? And don't be an asshole today. And don't make fun of people who are, in the minority or in the underclass or in, any position that is not a dominant position. We've moved beyond the era where it's appropriate to, exploit white privilege, let's say. So I think, anyone who's a certain age, every 30-year-old probably has embarrassing stuff on the internet from their teenage years at this point. And everyone who's in their 40s, 50s, and 60s grew up with people who were misbehaving in the office or saying bad things that were not suitable now. I mean, Obama wasn't for gay marriage until after Joe Biden. Obama was Mr. Traditional marriage for many years. You can cancel people for many reasons, and I think the most important thing is if we're not canceling everyone equally, we shouldn't be really doing, you know, we shouldn't cancel Al Franken and not cancel Donald Trump, for example.
We all remember 9/11, right? The Iraq War, George W. Bush.
Right.
What I find interesting is I remember the time when George W. Bush was a war criminal. At least that was, you know,
right.
It seemed to be at the time. Well, I find interesting there, you know, I think it was it last year, a couple of years ago, you know, pictures of him. Oh, he took up painting and he's friends with sitting with Michelle Obama. And it seems to be the culture seems to have forgiven him. Do you feel like, and I'm just thinking out loud here, Richard, I mean, is there a possibility in 15 years if Trump takes up painting and becomes friends with Michelle Obama, will the culture forgive him?
No, there's no redemption for Trump. I mean, we have to draw a line somewhere. I mean, his. He should never have run for president if he wasn't going to do the job. I think with Trump, it's completely different because George Bush was, in his own mind, a decent human being. Trump, in his own mind, knows what he is. He knows that he's rotten to the core. He's soulless. He's broken. And he's a despicable person. He's been corrupt from before he became president, and he's been corrupt from day one. The emoluments, the corruption, everything has been very, very bad. His incompetence and the handling of the virus, let alone the economy and everything else, that alone is reason to never forgive him for, you know, talking about injecting bleach and hydroxychloroquine and, you know, still retweeting this kind of nonsense in July 2020. And, you know, all of his bad personal behavior and the fact that he's, you know, a grotesque human being should, you know, are unforgivable. I mean, I think his behavior with women has been unforgivable and he's unrepentant about it. So I don't think there's a way forward for forgiveness for Trump, but anyone else, I'll consider. That's the reality. And, you know, his children are emulating him when they should be reining him in. You know, we thought Ivanka was going to go there and make him behave in the White House. Instead, she's getting trademarks from China and selling Goya beans on her Instagram. So it's, I mean, you know, they're a nightmare family. It's like we're living in a fictional universe where, you know, we've been taken over by, you know, aliens with no empathy.
We spent a lot of time on your political efforts. Now, obviously, your novel, Russell Wiley's Out to Lunch, and then also Kim Kardashian Saves the World.
Yes.
President Trump nearly ends it. Now, do you have anything you're working on now, and is it closely tied to current culture?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have been working on, I've put aside. I do have a novel that is non-political that is in the drawer right now, but it's not politically themed, but it takes on some of these issues of fake versus real, good versus evil, and the forces in the world that can dominate the people. And that's kind of a holistic kind of thematic look at what I'm working on right now. But short term, I'm working on using whatever little platform I have to save the world, because Kim Kardashian didn't step up in time.
Well, apparently, you know, Kanye West seems to be running for president.
Well, it's funny. I'm not sure what he's doing right now, and I'm not sure his bid is going to continue. But the reason I wrote that book, Kim Kardashian Saves the World After President Trump Nearly Ends It, was as a commentary on the ridiculousness of the celebrity culture that would even allow Trump to get close to the presidency. And that came out in the spring of 2016, and it imagined a world where Trump did actively try and start a nuclear war, did potentially bring an end to life on the planet as we know it, and it was only the existence of a secret deep state, which was the celebrity CIA, that had the power to step in and use the forces of social media for good to make the people rise up around the world and create a peace explosion. So that was my optimistic view for how we would get out of a disastrous Trump presidency. And that may be part of the reason we're getting out of the actual Trump presidency, because there is something of a rising up right now in terms of social media, not the way I imagined it in this little novella that I published, but through all these new super PACs like Midas Touch and Really American and even Project Lincoln, who were disgruntled Never Trumpers. There's a lot happening on social media. I'm not sure if it will ultimately make the difference, but a lot of it is now getting onto the airwaves as well, because these PACs are raising money through social media to put ads out in Texas and other important states. And Project Lincoln especially has raised $12.8 million last quarter. They're Republicans, anti-Trump. Midas Touch is now raising enough money to go on TV. They're a new group of brothers that just started their super PAC even just a few months ago and putting out hard-hitting anti-Trump ads. So there's a lot of potential social media wave that could have an impact ultimately in November. So I think the people of the world are ready for change. The whole world is, I mean, Trump is a laughingstock. The whole world is ready for change in America. It's what's happening here makes the whole world sad, I feel, that the disastrous response to the coronavirus has really made America seem like a failed state to much of the world. Europe's getting back to work, and this virus is out of control in most of America, and there's no real reason for it.
What is the vibe in New York City? Are you Manhattan or Brooklyn, or where are you? What part of the city are
well,
you?
Well, I'm in Manhattan now. I lived most of my time in New York. I lived in Brooklyn, but I'm in Manhattan these days. And the vibe, for me, I feel that the Trump and the virus, you know, have had a very similar trajectory. Trump got big in New York first, and then he went national, and New York rejected him and was too smart to ever want him back. And the same thing has happened with the virus, where Trump, through his incompetence and letting it seed here from Europe in February and into March, we got overwhelmed with it. And now New York and New Jersey and Connecticut banded together and smartly followed the rules and didn't reopen too quickly. And we've gone through hell, and we don't want it back. We know what the Trump virus is. We don't want it back. But the problem is it can come back anyway because it's so out of control in the rest of the country. So it's a similar story. Trump and the virus launched in New York, then went national and poisoned everyone.
Now, in your ideal world, Richard, who would you want to be president ideally in this next election? I know, you know, whether regardless of Biden, I mean, who's your ideal pick if you could snap your fingers?
Well, at the start, I've always been a big fan of Cory Booker, and I was hopeful that he would do better. I was hopeful Kamala Harris would do better. Ultimately, I'm happy that Biden represents a kinder, gentler patriarchy, if that's what we're going to have. I would be happy to have him. Any of the women vice presidents that he's thinking of nominating, I would be okay with. I would prefer probably Kamala Harris as the vice president. I would be happy for her to take over in 4 years. We don't need necessarily two terms of Uncle Joe. But if we can get stability and a vice president who trains on the job, learns quickly, and can take over in 4 years, that would be great. It would also be great if the most important thing is if the Senate can tip in November, because 4 more years of obstruction that Biden had for much of their 2 terms, that's really what made so much impossible to get, you know, so many things that were not done in those years were because of obstructionism, not because of the lack of will to do it.
Now, the public seems to have a short attention span and memory, and you mentioned Harris. I recall during some of the debates where she was calling Joe Biden racist. What are the optics around that if he chose her as a VP running mate?
I don't think there's any problem whatsoever with that. I think in the rough and tumble of the primary season, she took her shot. She had a moment to be ascendant. If we canceled Kamala Harris for doing that, then, you know, where does Lindsey Graham stand? Where do half the people working for Trump today called him a creepy pedophile that they wouldn't let their children near, or said he was totally inappropriate and a cancer on the Republican Party? So Kamala was nicer to Biden than most people working for Trump were in 2015 and 2016. The things, you know, Kellyanne Conway said a lot of bad things when she was working for Ted Cruz. Mick Mulvaney said a lot of bad things when he was made chief of staff. Lindsey Graham said Trump was a kook and would destroy the party, and now he's his golfing buddy and his water carrier in the Senate. So I think, you know, Kamala Harris, her resume will be discussed, but ultimately, it's like Mike Pence. No one really cared that Mike Pence was the disaster he would be if he ever had to take over. But Kamala Harris would be a much better vice president than any Republican vice president or nominee has been in the last 20 years. I mean, look at the disasters the Republicans have nominated. Sarah Palin, Paul Ryan, Mike Pence. Kamala Harris has got a lot more going for her than any of those guys.
But if Biden chose Kim Kardashian, would you be opposed to that? I'm kidding, Richard. Yeah, well, this has been a great conversation. I do, you know, you mentioned pedophiles. I am curious, being in New York and Jeffrey Epstein, that whole story in Maxwell. I mean, what are your thoughts on that as a writer, as a journalist, as a political, you know, commentator? What are your thoughts on the Epstein situation?
Well, the Epstein situation is something of a web that has got everyone tangled in it, from Trump to Clinton to royal families to foreign prime ministers. So there are so many tentacles to that, and, you know, I'm sure that Trump doesn't want the truth to come out. Clinton may not want the truth to come out either. Prince Andrew certainly doesn't want the truth to come out. I do know that Trump has a history that overlaps with sex trafficking, with his Trump models, with the parties he used to throw in New York that was widely reported in 2016, but no one paid too much attention to. So Trump was in this world with, I think, what's his name, Nick Cassavetti? The model agency guy. There's a model agency guy, there was Epstein, Trump running around. Trump wanted to get into modeling. He brought in all these models, underage models from Europe and Canada, put them in apartments, trotted them out to parties with his business associates in New York. He was seen running in and out of the Epstein mansion at all hours. That was reported in the British press in the year 2000. He was hanging out in Palm Beach with Epstein. So I think there's a lot there. Ghislaine Maxwell could tell a lot of tales. There's a lot of material being seized by Jeffrey Berman in the New York mansion when that raid was done. A lot of files and CDs and photographs and records were taken. What happens to them, I don't know. I think the Southern District of New York prosecutors have probably an open and shut case against Ghislaine Maxwell. Whether they do anything with it to expose other people or not remains to be seen.
I have two last questions. If you could privately get Trump and his family, or at least just Trump, in a room, what would you ask him or say to him? What would, you know, if you could get his ear and undivided attention, what would be the few things you'd really want to say to him if you could do that privately?
First off, I would give him five words that he hasn't memorized in advance and say, repeat these five words. And they would be strange words that were not mnemonically arranged by him to fit his person, woman, man, camera, TV memory trick. Then I would get back to those later. I would ask him why he hasn't released his tax returns. I would ask him why he hasn't resigned yet. I would ask him what deals he has with Putin that we should be aware of. There's no way of getting a straight answer out of him, obviously, on any of these questions, but I think it's a very sad situation that someone like that can rise to the presidency. After Obama, it's such a swing of the pendulum. You know, Obama was symbolic of America being a meritocracy, and Trump was just a symbol of America being a class system for the rich white elite to do what they want and shit on everyone else.
And the last question, if you had a few points to impress upon, that's fine. But if you had a few points to impress upon society, you know, what would they be?
To press upon society? Well, I think one of the first fundamental things that I would impress upon America is, in order to have a functioning society, there needs to be fairness in the tax system, the economic system, and, you know, we've reached this point of income inequality, which is on a parallel to where it was at the time of the French Revolution. So there's a reason people are mad and upset at the rich right now, and it's because the rich have been squeezing every last little drop out of every piece of fruit on the shelf. And income inequality is really a core problem that should be addressed. And as part of that, fairness to everyone. So there's no reason in the 21st century why the richest country in the world can't have basic food, healthcare, education, and housing for everyone. And if America can't do that for its own people, within some kind of quasi-capitalist world that we live in and give people opportunities, but the whole plan of Obama was to go back to the Clinton era tax rates, which is something that we've never got back to. Even the 90s, the taxes we paid in the 90s would be a much better setup than the taxes we're paying today. The taxes of the 50s and 60s would be even better. When America was quote unquote great, the upper tax brackets were far higher than they are today. So the idea that fairness is as a fundamental doctrine, I think, should be restored. And of course, competence in leadership would be good. But also the other thing is we do have to tackle this climate change issue. And if Trump gets reelected, it's, you know, a field day for corporate polluters, and the planet will be set back. I mean, the setback of the planet has been happening thanks to Rupert Murdoch and the Koch brothers for many, many years, and we're now getting into an emergency situation that we may have bought some time with this pandemic because there's less economic activity and less pollution being produced temporarily, but once things get back to normal, we really need to address in a competent way the climate change challenge.
You know, Richard, I do have one last question. Things are pretty uneasy, COVID-19, the political climate. Are there any things that you're looking forward to, or things that are going well, or things, do you have any optimistic views on anything that, you know, that you're looking forward to, that are things that are, you know, whether personally, professionally? I mean, is there anything you're looking forward to is there hope in the world, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I think there's always going to be hope in the world. The question is how soon. We're in such a disastrous moment with the virus and the economy right now, and so many people are going to be hurt economically on top of all the people who are going to come out of this with physical ailments or loss of family members and loved ones. So I do think that there's an opportunity for America to pull together, and I do think that someone like a Joe Biden is the person who can have that kind of aspirational leadership of encouraging people just to be their best selves. And I do think that the truth of America and the world is that the people are fundamentally good, and people want to help each other, and people want to build a better future for themselves and their families. And I do think that there's always a reason for optimism. And if you look at the Spanish flu, there was good times after that. There were a lot of bad times afterwards too. So we just need to we need to build back better. I'm happy with Biden's catchphrase here, his new slogan. I do think that people can work together. People are more willing, I think, now more than ever to kind of look out for each other and look out for their neighbors and build things from the grassroots back up. And I think if there's a structure that allows fairness and opportunity to be seen by all, especially, you know, the younger generation who are going to inherit all the debt and all the problems of the world, I do think that you know, a way forward that inspires youth and inspires communities is definitely possible.
Well, Richard, really appreciate your time. Great conversation. Just thank you so much.
Well, thanks.
Of the freedom of speech.
And the creation of
science. State our dangers and our opportunities.
This is our challenge. This is our time.